Welcome to the Texas Crimecast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-host this week is Naomi Martin.
Hi, hey, Tristan. Naomi.
Hi.
Naomi and I will talk a little bit more about the attacks in Oaklawn. We'll also be talking to quite a few other people today. Of course, editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end our show as usual with his commentary, Hashing It Out. Dallas Morning News Austin Bureau Chief Brandy Grissom will join us by phone to talk about prison suicides. And Dr. Melinda Schlager of the Carruth Police Institute will join us to talk about body cameras. But first, joining us in the studio to talk about illegal dumping is our colleague, reporter Connor Schein. Connor, how are you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. Connor, we have two kind of battles going on with illegal dumping. You have the city telling people, hey, knock it off, stop throwing stuff, either garbage or furniture or litter or, in a lot of cases, dead dogs, out in the wilderness. And then you have activists telling the city, hey, you're not doing your job. Could you tell us a little bit about what they're telling the city they're not doing?
Yeah, so a lot of the community angst and the anger comes from the dead dog issue, obviously, with, you know, that being a really personal one for a lot of, you know, a very active and engaged animal advocacy community here. And so Southern Dallas, where a lot of this dumping has happened, it's been a dumping ground for, my understanding, is decades. It's just a place where if you need to get rid of something, whether it's a dead dog, a piece of furniture, and sometimes a human body, it's kind of where people go. It's in the, and specifically in the Dowdy Ferry Road area, you can find a dead dog there almost daily. People are finding them and posting these pictures of these dogs to social media. And so there's some complaints from people who are involved, one, that these animals are not getting picked up in the quality of life that that causes, but two, that the city isn't doing enough to prevent these dogs from dying in the first place. A lot of these are stray dogs or some suspect animals that have been abused and victims of animal cruelty, and so they want to see the city prevent this from happening more.
I went to a press conference earlier this week. I'm infringing on your territory a little bit, but out there at Dowdy Ferry, which is, if you haven't been, it's a very kind of strange place to be actually in the city of Dallas, which you think of as this big city, especially if you're in the center of it. But one of the things that the police said there was it's extremely hard to prove these animal cruelty cases. I'm guessing that's not an acceptable answer to these activists.
Yeah, and so what? So it's oftentimes it's not hard to prove that there was some sort of abuse. They're finding animals that are mutilated, decapitated with their, you know, with broken bones, and some of them still have chains around their necks. But finding who's responsible for that is the tricky part for law enforcement agencies, because most of these animals are not microchipped, so it's hard to, they can't trace it back that way. They've started putting up cameras, but if they don't see it happen or someone doesn't see it happen, you know, they drive by, dump, and then they're right back on I-20 and kind of out of there pretty quickly. And so they just, there's not a whole lot of ways to find these people.
The city marshal's office has also been trying to raise awareness for the illegal dumping issue, not just dead dogs. They like to focus on the pollution aspect of it, too, mm-hmm. that people are just throwing stuff out. Could you tell me a little bit about their efforts?
Yeah, so the most recent one and the most visible one has been with the city marshals, has been they have installed some cameras along Dowdy Ferry Road, as my understanding. They haven't said how many, but one of those at least has already led to an arrest, at least. I'm not sure where the charges stand for a person for illegally dumping a dog. They caught his car on camera, and they went and tracked him down that way. And so there's some hope that that will help, but the sort of the pervasiveness of the, especially the dead dog issue, is going to require some enforcement on the front end of that too.
Do the police suspect that any of these dogs are related to dog fighting?
Yeah, and so that's kind of another area, is the people who live in the area and who are involved with the dumping issue, the dead dogs, they're convinced that the sheer number of these animals and the types of injuries that they have, it sort of indicates a more organized animal cruelty, or that there's, you know, a handful of people who are dumping a lot of dogs. Police have not been able to find any specific evidence of that, and the people that live there would question, you know, how hard they've been looking and how thorough the investigation has. But there has been a sense within the last few months that this is being taken more seriously by both law enforcement and city officials to try and figure out if there is a cause to this, whether it's organized animal abuse or whether it's just something that needs to be better enforcement of the laws that we already have.
In the things could be worse category, you were telling me yesterday about this. You came from Las Vegas a few months ago, that your newspaper there covered someone who ran animal services out in suburban Las Vegas. What was that all about?
Yeah, that was a weird one, and it hasn't been proven yet, but it was in a suburb of Las Vegas, Boulder City is what it's called, and this person who was the animal control supervisor responsible for the shelter was basically accused of killing animals, you know, for no reason, basically.
Fun, I think, was the term that was used.
Was the term they used, and I don't want to ascribe anything to her motivations, but there was an investigation that sort of fell apart, and so there were some questions about what her role in that was. And I think it's here in Dallas, there are concerns about the number of animals being killed at the shelter, but the shelter, I think, is limited in what it can do because of such a high volume of strays out on the street, and so the sense is that to address that problem, we got to deal with the strays and then work on improving conditions at the shelter.
All right, Connor, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
And thanks for having me.
So last Sunday, about 50 people had a rally outside Dallas Police Headquarters, and it seems like the gay community in general in Dallas has kind of been put on edge by a string of attacks in the Oaklawn area. I actually got a call from one of my friends in New Orleans saying, like, what's up with all these hate crimes in Dallas? Tristan, I know you've been covering this. Can you talk about whether these are all hate crimes or whether some of them are? What's going on?
So far, there have been 14 attacks, and obviously the rally was spurred by a fresh wave of about 3 robberies and involved a beating and one of the cases. The police have only called one of these a hate crime. And it's hard to prove that. It's hard to prove intent, especially when robbery seems to be the underlying motivation of a lot of these attacks. But geographically, it is in an area that's, as you mentioned, known as the gayborhood in Dallas. It's an area that where you're going to have a lot of people coming out of bars late at night. And the victims, for the most part, have been gay men who've been attacked, and usually alone, sometimes with other people, but often alone, late at night. And poor lighting has been cited as one of the causes. So it could be hate crimes. We don't know. I mean, it could just be opportunistic targeting, and that's what it looks like. I mean, there's robberies all over the city. This one specifically has struck a chord because of the community that's there and because it's sort of one of the well-known areas of Dallas where, you know, Mayor Rawlings and Councilmember Adam Medrano went out there and walked the neighborhood and talked about how important it is to Dallas's nightlife, to Dallas's economy, and it's this bustling area. But it has produced some positive results. Medrano is contributing bond money to helping improve lighting or whatever else. They haven't found out what exactly they're going to spend it on, but they're hoping public safety improvements in the area. And a reward has been increased, and I expect it to continue going up. It's now $12,500 if anyone has any information on these attacks.
Have any of the attacks been particularly violent, or are they just robberies?
They have been violent. There was one person, I think, who was just beaten senseless, and he doesn't remember anything. He doesn't think he was robbed, but he doesn't remember what provoked it. He was coming out of a bar. You know, he was knocked unconscious, so it's hard to say exactly what the cause was. But for the most part, they have been robberies similar to the ones that we were seeing on the Katy Trail a few months back.
And have the police stepped up any patrols, or what are they trying to do to prevent any more attacks?
The whole area, the last time I was there, is swarming with police cars, and the worry is that they're just going to slowly start fading away. We haven't had many, if any, attacks that I know of in the area since police have stepped up patrols there. Obviously, that's a huge deterrent, is seeing a police car drive by every 5 seconds. But for now, that's they say that they're going to be there as long as they need to be. Joining us now on the phone is Austin Bureau Chief Brandy Grissom. Brandy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Good. Brandy, you wrote a story, I believe it was last week, about prison suicides and how they've increased both in numbers of attempts and in successful attempts. And in some of these institutions, they're supposed to monitor them more closely. Could you tell us a little bit about what you found out?
Sure. So I asked the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to provide us with data on suicides and suicide attempts at each of the state's 109 prisons from 2008 through September of 2015. And what that data showed is that during that time period, there's an increase of 30% in the number of attempted suicides, increasing from about 750 in 2008 to 935 in 2014, or 980 in 2014, and then there have already been 935 this year. And the number of suicides that were completed, that number had increased 40%. So what advocates are really saying is that you know, these numbers are troubling, and that they indicate a need for a better training of officers, for improved mental health care provision at the facilities, and also for just some recognition and some independent oversight of the facilities in Texas.
Do you have any idea what percentage of these inmates were supposed to be under, like, constant monitoring or, solitary confinement or sort of, like, just under close watch, like suicide watch or something?
Well, a separate set of data that I got showed that from 2011 to 2014, the number of suicides, 30% of the suicides happened in solitary confinement, and those inmates are supposed to be watched very carefully, and they only account for 4% of the total prison population. So the fact that so many of the suicides are happening in solitary confinement, advocates for change in the prison system say that is particularly troubling.
What do people say is the reason for why this is happening? Why there are so many more attempts at suicide in prisons?
Well, as you might suspect, the reason depends on who you ask. The officials at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice explain that, you know, even though their population in prisons is dropping, and it's dropped something like 6% over the last several years, more of the inmates that they have are experiencing a lot of mental health issues. And we find that is true in jails and other confinement institutions across the state. And so they're saying, you know, they're also saying, look how many of these that we're preventing. There were 900 plus attempts, and yet, you know, only 30 suicides. They say that, you know, they're doing the best they can, that any suicide is bad and something they don't want to see happen, but that they're dealing with this more difficult population. And then if you talk to the advocates who want changes in the system, they think that the problem is really, you know, one of conditions, and the fact that there's not enough oversight of the inmates, but also of the way that TDCJ operates.
Is there any push for any sort of reform? Because the one thing about this is you don't, other than Sandra Bland, which was a jail incident, you don't often hear about prisoners committing suicide. And I imagine there's a sense in some segments of the population that, you know, who cares? These are criminals. But is there any sort of push for changing this at the state level?
Well, you're right. There hasn't been a lot of talk at all about prison suicide. Lawmakers are looking specifically at jail suicide in the wake of the Sandra Bland death. But really, there hasn't been much discussion about suicides in prisons in Texas. One thing that we have seen is some discussion about limiting the use of solitary confinement in Texas prisons. And the prison system over the last few years has done has reduced the use and the percentage of inmates who are in solitary confinement, particularly for long periods of time, has dropped. But in terms of the situation of suicides overall, there really hasn't been any discussion of that. And I think that some of the advocates for change would like to see more discussion during the legislative session in 2017 and perhaps before.
Well, that's a long way off. Well, we hope to hear more from you on that. Brandy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
So we have Dr. Melinda Schlager, who's the director of the Carruth Police Institute, which is a research organization that looks at North Texas police agencies. And she's in the studio today to talk about body cameras and the research that her institute is doing on the Dallas Police Department's body cameras. Welcome, Melinda.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. So after Ferguson and Baltimore and all these controversial police incidents around the country, a lot of departments are getting these cameras, and, you know, it seems like everyone's sort of like rushing to get these body-worn cameras. Chief Brown has joked about wanting to buy stock in them. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, so you guys are doing some research on, you know, the Dallas Police Department is rolling out 200 body-worn cameras. And you have told me that your research is a little different than the research that's being done around the country. Can you talk about why your research is a little different?
Sure. First, yes, body cameras are the new topic technology du jour. For a variety of reasons, most of them, I think, obvious to anybody who even marginally watches or reads the news. And yes, they are a valuable technology that I think departments around the nation can benefit from using. But there are so many components of these cameras, or so many facets of the use of the cameras that have to be considered. And so when research on body cameras started, it's been a while, actually. It's probably been five, 6 years. So it does go back a while anyway. It started out in California with a study out of Rialto, California, and a good study, solid study. They were interested in looking at cameras, but didn't consider some of the things that, of course, are now issues. I mean, that was when cameras were kind of new and novel and people didn't really know what to do with them and didn't, I mean, they knew what to do with them, but they didn't realize the impact that what was happening in the nation would have on their use. And so studies on body cameras have evolved. And in fact, you have a large push by the federal government to actually issue funding, grant funding for studies on body cameras. And so the push has been to move away from studies that just compare groups to what we know in research to be randomized controlled trials. That is where everybody has an equal opportunity to be selected to either be in the treatment or the control group. And the beauty, of course, of randomized controlled trials is that it helps eliminate or minimize bias, something that, of course, those of us in research are always concerned about. The problem with randomized controlled trials now with body cameras is that there have been so many large events that have occurred that the opportunity to find a group of officers or departments, or chiefs from departments who are willing to entertain that kind of study are smaller and smaller. And so originally we had hoped...
Because so many officers want the cameras.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you're an officer now, if you were an officer 5 years ago, you wanted the camera because, this is getting to my earlier point, because it was a cool new piece of technology. You want to try it out. You want to see how it works. And you understand the benefits of it. But the national tenor, the national conversation then, of course, was not nearly what it is now. So now you have more and more officers who not only want to wear the cameras, you've got some time behind you, you've got people looking at other departments and seeing how they use them, but you've also got this situation where officers don't want to be caught without them, both for their own safety and the safety of the citizens that they serve.
They see it as a protection against false accusations.
And not only for themselves, but, I mean, really for the citizens at large. I mean, you know, the theory behind the camera is that it's going to be the objective arbiter of the event that occurs. But of course, there's a fallacy in that because the camera only sees a situation from one vantage point, right? It can't, you can't see the officer, you can hear the officer, but you can't see the officer. What you do see, of course, is the citizen and anything that, so the notion of the cameras as a more sort of theoretical thing is an interesting conversation to have. But from the policing perspective, they absolutely see it as something that can help them protect them and help them better do their jobs.
So I remember you telling me that, you know, you kind of compared it to like going to Toyota, getting your car fixed. You get a call afterwards from someone at this auto shop saying, you know, how was your service, you know, 1 to 10. And you guys are going to be doing that with officers now, right? You're going to be calling
them. Yes, we are.
Can you talk about why you're doing that?
Yes. So our study is going to have a group of is going to include a group of officers who wear cameras. And because of the way that the Dallas Police Department is rolling out the cameras, and they're doing it in a very thoughtful way. It's not just take 3,500 officers and throw out 3,500 cameras. That would be horrible.
It'd also be a very expensive
not to mention the expense. I mean, that's, yes, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, they're doing it in a very thoughtful way. They're rolling it out, and they've got a whole plan for doing so. But the fact remains is that we will be comparing people who wear cameras, and then there'll, of course, be a group of officers for a while who don't have them. And we'll be able to compare and look at things like use of force complaints or commendations, actually, and all kinds of things. But one of the things that we were very interested in looking at when we were looking at the cameras was this notion of police legitimacy. And police legitimacy, for those who may not know what it is kind of a esoteric term, but it has real life application. So the idea is that society has given, through the social contract in which we live, this idea that the police are a legitimate force. We give them, we will them that power.
To arrest us and possibly have to shoot people.
Protect us. Mm-hmm. Yes, arrest and shoot, but really about protect. And of course, you know, most of the work that police officers do is not about arresting people or locking them up or, you know, shooting and things like that. It is about public and civic engagement. And so society wills that authority to the police. And what we've seen over time, and especially over the last year or so, is not so slow erosion in that legitimacy, that society is beginning to question the degree to which they want to or will allow police to do that. So that was really the focus of our study. And so we there's been some work done by an author, Lorraine Mazerol, who has looked at measures of police legitimacy. And what we did was we created, it's just like the car self-satisfaction survey. You take your car in, you find, you know, they email you or call you the day later and say, how was your service? So what we will be doing is we will be calling people who have engaged with officers, both those who wear cameras and those who don't. And we will be asking them about their experience, that police citizen engagement opportunity that they had with that officer. And we will be asking certain questions that get to the very issue of police legitimacy. So it's not something that's been routinely done, but we see it as a really novel way to try to get at something that's very hard to measure.
We've heard over the years, and especially recently, that body cameras can change the behavior of both officers and the citizens. And this is sort of small-scale stuff. Obviously, body cameras, new technology. Do you believe that there's any legitimacy to that idea that the cameras will, knowing that you're on camera both for the officer and for the, you know, arrested person or whoever's interacting with the officer, changes their behavior?
Absolutely. I mean, how can it not? Think about yourselves. Think about when you know you're being filmed or, you know, somebody's got a camera out. That absolutely is the case. But I think everybody in the business, everybody who's working with these cameras or working in policing and or criminal justice at large, recognizes that can only benefit benefit everybody, really.
And what are you hoping the research shows?
Okay, so we want the research to show what the research is going to show. Of course, as good scholars and researchers, it will be what it is. But ideally, what we'd like to see, if we could have the perfect world, is that officers who wear cameras have fewer use of force complaints, more commendations, and that legitimacy that I was talking about, that people who engaged with an officer who wore a camera felt that interaction was a better quality interaction than perhaps people who didn't. But again, that's an academic hypothesis that we have. And to really project what we think we're going to find would be is probably not a good thing to do.
Well, and it's not just all up in the clouds research. I mean, this could have impact on potential funding, right? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, you know, you pointed out that there's a function of money here. I mean, the amount of money that the city of Dallas and the Dallas Police Department has put toward body cameras is enormous. And you do want to make sure whenever you're rolling something out and you're being thoughtful about doing it, that you know, you are nimble enough to change as you go. And if there are results from our study that can help Dallas Police Department or, in fact, any police department better do their jobs, then that's our goal. I mean, as a research institute, that's our purpose, is to provide evidence-based research that helps officers and law enforcement personnel better do their jobs.
Do you think that the body cameras can restore that legitimacy that's been eroding that you mentioned?
I think it can, to a degree. But I mean, you know, if you're asking me personally, I think it's much more than the camera. I think that, as I said, the camera is only going to capture one point of view. So this notion that it is a neutral arbiter is really a false one. There is somebody who's wearing the camera. It's only getting one perspective. But will it shed light on situations that perhaps people say happened one way, but really happened another. Absolutely. I think anything that we can do in this conversation that the nation is having about people understanding better what people do and why they do it is a good conversation to have. And I think the cameras can help us do that.
All right. Dr. Melinda Schlager, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We'll have a new Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto in just a moment. But before we go, we have a bit of a plug. Our guest a few weeks back, Christopher Scott, who served a dozen years in prison for a murder he didn't commit and was exonerated, and his charity, House of Renewed Hope, are holding a fundraiser in Richardson next Thursday night. That is December 10th. It starts at 7 p.m. and tickets are $35 a pop. You can buy them online at houseofrenewedhope.org. Speaking of websites, don't forget to visit dallasnews.com for all the stories you heard today and continuing coverage of crime, courts, and public safety issues. You can also like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. Our producer and sound engineer today is Tommy Noel. Thanks again to Austin Bureau Chief Brandy Grissom, reporter Connor Schein, and Dr. Melinda Schlager. Stock guest list today. For Naomi Martin, I'm Tristan Hallman. Thanks for listening, and we hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
It's okay to admit that your eyes might glaze over a bit when the argument of the day is freedom of the press. Free speech you get. That's your right to say what you believe. Freedom of the press, that's for those reporter types. Except it's not, actually. Both rights, and that's what they are, stem from the same amendment to the same Constitution, ours. Say what you will, and you do, press freedom is as important to you living your life as anything. Disagree? Well, that's your right. But look at it this way. Is it better to know or not know what your government is doing when you're not looking? There you go. And that's part of what a free press does for you. This came up again because State District Judge Deborah Oakes Evans decided she would ignore the Constitution. She issued a gag order on media coverage of criminal proceedings into the massacre of six people at an Anderson County campsite in East Texas. For reasons unknown, Judge Evans decided unilaterally that the formerly free press could report only what she said it could, as far as William Hudson's trial goes. Thankfully, the judge came to her senses this week and backtracked on much of her order. She isn't talking, which is her right, as long as she doesn't restrain the rest of us.